Most excitingly, just earlier this year, he was announced as the new cellist in the Emerson Quartet, receiving another cheer from the crowd here at the Royal Albert Hall. Yes, the Emerson Quartet, perhaps the best quartet in the world, some say. They haven't had a change in their lineup for 34 years. They could have had anyone. They chose Paul Watkins when their cellist left. So he's moved to New York to play with them. As I say, great news for them and for him. But wonderful response to that Lutosławski cello concerto here in the Royal Albert Hall. Polish music is one of the themes of this year's prom season. We heard some Lutosławski on the first night. We heard his variations on a theme of Paganini. And you'll be able to hear the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, the BBC Chorus of Wales, and the BBC Symphony Chorus is Szymanowski's third symphony, the Song of the Night, tomorrow night, live here on Radio 3, home of the proms. Now, Paul Watkins has come back to the stage for a second time, which makes me think we might get an encore.
More Lutosławski.
More Lutosławski indeed from Paul Watkins. That was his Zacher variation for solo cello, written in 1975, one of the many tributes paid to Paul Zacher, the founder and conductor of the Basel Chamber Orchestra and Choir, great commissioner of new works, on the occasion of his 70th birthday in 1976. Well, the applause and the appreciation for Paul Watkins continues, as you can hear, here in the Royal Albert Hall, and from the BBC Symphony Orchestra, his old colleagues as well. He's today's featured Plums artist, you'll be interested to hear, here on BBC Radio 3. When we asked for three of his top musical recommendations for you to listen to, he said Bach Gobbo Variations, no surprise for cellos, Britten War Requiem, and Mozart's Divertimento in E-flat for string trio. So there you go, there's some hints and recommendations from Paul Watkins, and what better man to take some recommendations from. As you can hear, the applause has come to an end. It's time for the interval here at the Royal Albert Hall at the Proms tonight. And in keeping with the Polish theme of this year's Proms, here is Rana Mitter.
In Britain, we have an awful lot to thank Poland for. Joseph Conrad, fighter pilots during the Battle of Britain. Pickled cucumber. Okay, maybe not the pickled cucumber. But in the last couple of decades, Poland has moved from the edge of our consciousness to the centre of our lives. Poles are now the largest minority group living in the UK, and they're visible everywhere in our labour force. Polish is the third most spoken language on these islands, after English and Welsh. But the one place where Poles lack visibility in our national life is in the literary world. The influx of immigration from Asia and Africa led to the redefinition of British writing as global writing. But what are Poles in Britain reading and writing? And what should we be reading to find out more? Well, to explore this question, I have two writers who are, as you might say, at opposite poles. Eva Hoffman is originally from Krakow, but has worked around the world and won acclaim for her memoir, Lost in Translation. A.M. Bacalar is the first Polish woman writer to publish a novel in English since the accession of Poland to the EU in 2004. And that's her much-acclaimed novel, Madame Mephisto. Would you please welcome them both here tonight? Asia, you've said in the past that Poles are Britain's invisible minority. And that might even be true of someone who the British think of as one of their great writers, and that, of course, is Joseph Conrad. It seems to me that the Polish element of his personality has been claimed and overwritten, in a sense, by his Britishness. British, yes. Do you think Poland needs to reclaim him?
I remember when I was studying English literature at the university back in Poland, in Wrocław, and we always, when we were taught about Joseph Conrad, we always thought about him as a British writer, not a Polish writer. Of course, we knew his real name, which was Korzeniowski, because he changed it later, because he was just like a mouthful. But to me, he was always a British writer. Maybe because he never really wrote about Polish people or Poland and Polish identity. Maybe that's why. And I think that's the reason.
I wonder, though, if, Eva, there's another reason for that loss, and this is one where I have to point the finger a little bit, perhaps, at our own tendencies in Britain not to engage with other languages. I mean, very few British people now or in the past have ever learnt any Polish, fewer even than learn French or Spanish. And is there a sense in which we as a culture have willfully closed an important cultural door?
Well, I think that, you know, you have closed the door, but not willfully. I mean, in other words, you know, Polish is a very difficult language. So entering, you know, Polishness and Polish culture via the language is hard, is difficult. There are other ways, of course, to enter the culture and to understand the culture, yes.
What do you mean by that, Eva? I mean, I've heard that, not least from many Polish people, that Polish is very difficult. Mm. But, you know, it's an Indo-European language, it's got conjugations, declensions, a lot of people used to learn Latin in this country. Mm. What's so special about Polish? Are you trying to keep it away from us?
Yes, it's a conspiracy, actually. Polish is considered by linguists to be one of the most difficult languages to learn. I cannot tell you exactly why, but there are cases, there are declensions. What?
It's one of the top five most difficult languages in the world.
Exactly. Yeah. It has declensions, cases, tenses, irregularities, many irregularities. It just, you know, isn't easy. It's not impossible, of course, and there are now, you know, people who come to Poland from other places and who actually do learn and master the language. So it's not impossible.
And the pronunciation is really difficult as well. There are tongue twisters, which I could say one of them if you'd like to hear it.
Give us a very quick burst of the Polish tongue twister.
This one is about a beetle that buzzes in the grass. Chrząszcz brzmi w trzcinie, w szczebrzeszynie.
Okay, I've now decided I will stick to Chinese, which is a much easier language, which I have been studying for some years, and stay away from Polish. But there is a change in the air, isn't there, Asia? Because
yes.
More Polish literature is now being put into English, not least by small presses. I think you're an editor for one of those. Mm. And I'm wondering, a few years ago, decades ago, for the Indian, the South Asian diaspora, there was a sense of a push from within the community that helped to create a new, more visible literature. Is that happening with Pole Lit as well?
I don't think that there is a push from within the Polish community here in Britain to write. If people choose to write, Poles living here in the UK, they usually write in Polish. I remember going to Edinburgh and I met a group of writers, Polish writers, and they write in Polish with Scottish slang words. Which makes it more difficult if they want to get published in Poland because no one will understand it. So it's a kind of contained literature to Scotland because I couldn't understand it either because I don't speak any Scottish slang or whatever.
So who is that literature for, the community of Poles who live in Scotland?
I think they write for themselves, they write to each other in a way. But the thing is that there is a big problem with the language, like with the English. If you want to write, of course, if you write in Polish, then you hope that you'll be able to, you know, publish your book in translation. But choosing to write in English as a Pole is difficult because not every Pole speaks fluently in English and writes. You know, writing is a completely different thing. Like Eva and I, we write in English, which was a decision we made a long time ago. But it is difficult.
But perhaps, you know, two things perhaps should be added. I mean, first of all, that the Indian writers had the advantage very often of having been educated in English, in part at least. So there is that. But, you know, usually diasporic literature is a second or third generation phenomenon. So, you know, if the Polish immigration remains here, there probably will be a kind of Polish-British literature, as there is Italian or Jewish literature in the States.
So in other words, we're at the same position now with Polish diaspora literature in Britain that we were with South Asian literature, let's say, in about 1960, something like that.
I would say so, or yes.
I mean, a difficult question in one way, Asia, but it comes from current political debates. Mm. Is there a sense that the literature is not emerging because perhaps the Polish community that exists here now is not here to stay? It's not there to put down roots?
That's one of the reasons, but another reason is that people come here to make money. So, you know, writing is not exactly on their mind.
But few Indians came here initially to write. They also came for economic reasons.
Yeah, you're right. However, you know, the recent generation, they're surrounded by the Polish language and they don't feel the necessity to speak.
I want Eva to come to our first recommendation in terms of Polish literature. And I should just say that you've actually just had two Sunday features, documentaries, broadcast on BBC Radio 3 about the relationship between Poles and Jews in the 20th century. And I have to say that was in my mind, they were marvellous programmes, when I saw that you'd chosen Paweł Hüller's Who Was David Weiser as your first literary choice. Tell us a bit more about this novel.
Yes. This is a novel which describes an encounter between several schoolboys who are on summer vacation and who are a little bit bored, schoolboys who are perhaps 11 or 12 years old, and who meet a very mysterious boy of their age, who is most probably Jewish, although his origins are not completely clear, and whom they initially try to humiliate, but who turns out to have mysterious and really magical powers, and whom they begin to follow like a sort of magus or Svengali, and who specializes in these performances of explosions, which are almost, you know, a form of performance art, and who eventually vanishes in an explosion. David Weiser, the protagonist, is a kind of revenant from the past. And he not only knows about a lot about the city as it is now, but he introduces the other boys to the city's pre-war and wartime past, but particularly its pre-war past when Gdansk, the novel is set in Gdansk, when Gdansk had a large German population and a
Danzig
Jewish population. It was Danzig, yes. So he introduces them to that past as well. But one reason I chose this book is because it is a very early example of a phenomenon which is very evident in recent Polish literature and post-89 literature, and that is a kind of recovery of the past, a recovery of aspects of Polish history which were suppressed or repressed or censored or forgotten during the communist decades. And particularly, there is a kind of leap backwards over the communist decades and even over the war to the interwar period, when Poland was a very multicultural country, and particularly in its borderland region, particularly in its Ukrainian regions and its Western regions. So he often in his novels has characters who belong to vanished groups, Mennonites or Kashubians or others.
And of course, I've met some Lithuanians who still haven't forgiven the Poles for taking Vilnius away from them in the interwar period.
But not to speak of Lwów.
Right. Well, we won't dig up too many old memories. But Asia, is there a sense in which writers who concentrate on really the post-1989 liberal democratic Poland are still concerned with the kind of questions of memory that Eva's talked about? Or is this kind of old news, old hat for that generation of writers?
No, I think writers, especially in Poland, some of them still write about this. They revisit the past, especially the past during the communist period, during the Solidarity movement. Interestingly, there is quite a few crime novels being published at the moment in Poland that go back to that time, and the setting is basically during the communist times.
Let's take that moment to move on to your first recommendation, Asia, and that is a book by Anya Lipska called Where the Devil Can't Go. And we should say that Lipska herself is British, but she's married to a Pole. Could you just tell us a little bit about this book?
Yes, this is a very interesting, and the reason why I have selected Anya is because this is a book about Polish people in London. And she wrote this book initially, and she self-published the book, because she couldn't find a publisher in the UK. And the book was also published in Germany, but for some reason she couldn't find a publisher here in the UK. Because the publishers here in the UK were not convinced that a book about Polish people could be sellable.
Commercially viable,
basically. But she has become such a huge success selling the book as an e-book. She eventually found the publisher, and the book was released this year as well as a paperback. The book is about Kiszka, who is a fixer for solving different problems that Polish community has in London. And he one day has a case of a missing girl, and he goes to the Polish community, to one family, to find out what happened to that girl. At the same time, a body of a young woman is being washed ashore the River Thames, but the investigation takes Kiszka to the past of Poland during the Solidarity movement, which is quite interesting what we just said. So here we have a British writer who goes back to Polish history.
I mean, it's an interesting thing here, as you say, a writer from the majority culture here, as it were, deciding to place herself inside a minority one. Mm-hmm. And obviously you admire the book, you've chosen it, but does it ring entirely true to someone like yourself who sits within that group?
I absolutely loved it. I was reading it curiously because I wanted to find out how she will portray Polish people here in London. And it was really, really accurate, in terms of food, in terms of behavior. And one of the most interesting things about the book is how Anya shows different generations of immigration. So you've got the older generation, which is more surrounded, concentrated around the church, around very strongly within the Polish community. They don't really speak English. They're very traditional. Whereas the younger generation, like Kiszka himself, for example, or the people that he's meeting in his path, the younger people, they're completely different. They go out, they hang out with the British people as well. They don't really have that much in common with the older generation. So it's very interesting how she has portrayed those two levels in a way. Of
and I have to say, one sees all sorts of similarities there with the generational change in other diaspora communities as well. But let me turn to you, Eva, for another recommendation. And this is another literary sensation, in this case, Olga Tokarczuk's Primeval and Other Times. Now, this is a sort of Polish magical realism, is that right?
Well, no, it is very hard to categorize. And one of the reasons that I chose this book is precisely because it exists so much outside the usual categories, literary categories almost. It's a very original book. The title is very difficult to translate because the first word of it, which is translated as primeval, is Prawiek, and Prawiek is the name of a village, but it also means something like pre-age. And it is a novel about a village which exists in the center of the world and really in the center of the cosmos, and which in a sense is its own world and its own cosmos. It is completely sufficient. It has everything that a world needs. And the novel is told through voices of many kinds of characters, of the villagers, peasants, farmers, who are the inhabitants of Prawiek, of characters who live, who are almost pre-verbal, non-verbal, who are almost wild, who live in nature.
She is quite unusual on the Polish literary scene, because now I don't think there is another writer that writes the way she does, with that kind of allegorical way.
Well, I wouldn't say she's allegorical, you see. I mean, I think she creates a world of a kind of metaphysical world, a kind of philosophical world. At the center of it is a game played by the nobleman, and it's a metaphysical game in which he tries to figure out the limits of the, you know, of the universe. And to counter his own kind of despair. I mean, it is a philosophical work, I would say, and also a work of somebody who worked as a therapist for a long time.
Oh, yes, she did, didn't she? Yes,
yes, right. and who, you know, is a Jungian, and so it has that kind of mythography, but it is a very broad mythography. Mm. Can I say that this is simply a very beautiful book and a very lyrically written book?
Well, that is a lovely moment, I think, for me to change gears in a sense. Asia, you've chosen another novel which may be lyrical, but certainly you could say that it is, in Polish literary terms, hotter than a kielbasa covered in extremely spicy mustard. And we're talking here about the novel Snow White Russian Red by Dorota Masłowska. And this shocked the critics when it came out. Why?
It did, because it's full of vulgar language. It is. There is lots of swear words. So that, in terms of language, if you just look at the language, it is something that has never happened in Polish literature before. Because literature is quite serious in Poland. You know, writing books and writers are treated with huge respect. So now you have this. I think she was 19 years old when she published this book. It was a bit of a shock because she was talking in the language of. The book, maybe I tell what the book is about, it will be kind of easy to understand why she's using a certain that kind of language.
Yes, give us a quick summary.
Yes, yeah. The book is about a young man, his name is Andrew, and he's wearing tracksuits every single day. He's the kind of equivalent of the British chav, you know. So he swears a lot, he is constantly stoned, he takes loads of drugs, and he, one day, a friend tells him that his girlfriend betrayed him and doesn't love him anymore. And that completely shakes his belief in love, and he decides to go partying all the time. So that's the kind of the first storyline of the book. The narrative is almost like drug-infused narrative, so it's not straightforward when you read it.
So is Irvin Welsh maybe the comparison
yes,
here, Trainspotting?
Yeah, exactly. It's something along those lines. The other thing is, I wanted to come back to what you were saying earlier about the politics and the young people becoming more open and not exactly like going towards being less conservative. This book is an example that is not the case because those young people are quite racist. And the idea, I read an interview with her and how she came to write this book. Basically, she heard the story of a young man who was in a pub in one of the small towns in northern Poland. And this a skinhead popped into the pub and said, okay, we've got a Polish-Russian war happening. there were five Russians in that particular village or small town, and we have Polish-Russian war. And obviously, if you know the history of Poland, you know that because of the Soviet occupation, you know, that's one of the reasons. But recently, there's been loads of cases in Poland of racial abuse, especially in the northern eastern Poland.
Against Russians or?
No, against Romanians, against Ukrainians, against people of a different skin color rather than white. So this book, which was published in 2002, is surprisingly contemporary. It hasn't aged at all.
I mean, rather than magical realism, perhaps, Eva, is there a question of brutal realism emerging into the new Polish literature?
Masłowska perhaps could be seen as an example of brutal realism, but it is also a very hilarious book. I mean, it is very, very funny. And it satirizes all kinds of pieties. I mean, it satirizes the right-wing pieties, but it also satirizes the language of political correctness. I mean, there are characters who have a very good line in, in very politically correct and sort of high-minded and moral ways.
What does politically correct mean in Poland, though, Eva? Because it's a country with a completely different background from here.
Yes. Well, it's a complete imitation of Western political correctness. You know, so there are concerns about health, food and environment, all, you know, very, very right concerns, very, very proper concerns. But the language of it is satirized quite mercilessly here, as is, you know, the language of kind of racism and nationalism Poland for the Poles, as are the pre-war pieties of, you know, the Polish tragedy, the tragic history, and, you know, the exalted role of the writer, all of it, really.
Well, if nothing else, I think tonight here at the Royal College of Music, we have given people a great many new recommendations for their Christmas reading lists, or at least earlier than that, if you can't wait till wait that long. But I think I'd like to give a great deal of thanks here at the end of this event to our twin pole stars, Eva Hoffman and Asha Bakala. Thank you very much.
That was Rana Mitter in conversation with Eva Hoffman and Asha Bakala, and the producer was Laura Thomas. And the two Sunday features mentioned by Eva, and indeed presented by Eva Hoffman, are still available to listen again and to download if you go to the website. But welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall. From me, Katie Derham, to tonight's BBC Prom. We are live here on BBC Radio 3 with the BBC Symphony Orchestra. The figure of death looms over all three pieces on the programme tonight, with a dance of death or Totentanz in each one of them. In the first half of the concert, we heard Britten's Sinfonia de Requiem, his anti-war statement written in 1940. We heard Witold Lutosławski's cello concerto, often seen as a comment of the struggle of the individual against the forces of the state, state communism in 1960s Poland in that instance. And now we are going to hear Totentanz by tonight's conductor, Thomas Adès, who over the last 20 years has earned a reputation as one of the finest composers working today. We're going to hear his world premiere of this 35-minute piece, commissioned by Robin Boyle in memory of Witold Lutosławski and of his devoted wife, Danuta. In 2010, Thomas Adès found himself in the old German Baltic city of Lübeck. He was wandering around the streets and the churches, and he was astonished to find the ever-present figure of death, a constant reminder to the medieval citizens of their ultimate fate. There were wall paintings in the churches, there was a town clock with death accompanied by time chiming the hours, and there was one particular image of the Totentanz which grabbed his attention. In it, death was portrayed dancing with a series of characters, from the Pope to a child, via an emperor, a cardinal, a king, a monk, a knight, a mayor, a doctor, a usurer, a merchant, parish clerk, handworker, peasant, and maiden. The paintings were accompanied by verses in which death addresses each character in turn, who then responds with a lament, a sorrowful resignation, or a futile appeal for clemency. Well, the result of this inspiring work is a piece scored for very large orchestra, including the most fantastic selection of percussion. I think we have eight percussionists on stage tonight, and the biggest drum I've ever seen, and two voices, a baritone who sings death and a mezzo-soprano who sings all the other characters. But before we hear the piece, let's hear from Thomas Adès himself about his visit to Lübeck, and indeed about the piece.
It felt very like being in the 1200s or 1300s, when this place was largely originally built. You could feel how it might have been to be there. And I found the book of this now-destroyed Totentanz frieze in the church where it had been, in the Marienkirche. And I just could not resist it. I just couldn't put it down. And I took it home and I thought, there's a piece here. Of course, the human characters are from widely differing spheres of life, from the Pope to the peasant and the child at the end. And if you look at the pictures, death has a very different attitude to all of them in the dance. And he's obviously having a lot of fun. They're very funny, the pictures, and they're sort of absurd, caperings, dances. For example, the monk, it almost is rather a seductive relationship between death and the monk, as though death has sort of figured out the monk's deepest repressed desires and is saying, you want to dance. So I set that one as this waltz. But obviously the maiden, it's much gentler. It's quite a large percussion section. I think we have 8 or 9 players here. And I wanted it to have that quality of folk dancing a bit with the sort of clattery folk instruments like the bones and the clappers. It's a danse macabre, which means the same thing as Totentanz, exactly.
Well, caught up in that maelstrom of the danse macabre are the two voices. Simon Keenlyside is the baritone who sings Death tonight, and the mezzo-soprano Christiana Stottein takes on all those other characters who are carried away dancing by death, and they sing in the original German. But that applause you can hear greets Christiana Stottein and Simon Keenlyside as they come out onto the stage here at the Royal Albert Hall with composer and conductor Thomas Adès to perform his Totentanz with the BBC Symphony Orchestra.
Up! Good day! Das Goldne von drei Kronen, der Hut ist viel zu hoch, du musst jetzt enger wohnen.
Für dich. finden.
Ein strenger Orden schreibt mir tausend Regeln für. Jetzt greift der Tod mich an und ruft: Folge mir! Ich bin noch nicht bereit, mein Kloster zu verlassen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The eerie, unsettling, and yet really rather beautiful Totentanz by Thomas Adders, the world premiere of his much-awaited new work. The BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by the composer, who is currently bringing them to their feet, thanking them and also congratulating tonight's soloists, mezzo-soprano Christian Stottein and baritone Simon Keeneyside. Bringing them to the front of the stage, and you can hear the response of the crowd. Simon, who is no stranger to all the great opera houses, of course, of the world, sang Prospero in Thomas Adders's second opera, The Tempest. Tonight he sang Death. And Christian Stottein sang, well, everyone else, from Pope through to the child at the end, who sang, "Oh, Death, how can I understand? I cannot walk, yet I must dance." What a line. The piece, based on that 15th century Totentanz, frees in the Church of St. Mary in Lübeck, which so inspired Thomas Adders when he was visiting a few years ago. The hanging was itself destroyed. Even the copy was destroyed in the Second World War, but he found inspiration, warmly rewarded now by this audience, in the copies that still exist, the drawings and so on, of this hanging of the death, of the dance of death, Totentanz. I mentioned before that many critics are here tonight expecting a really rather special performance, a very significant world premiere. We premiere so many new works at the Proms every year, all of them, of course, you can hear live on Radio 3, but tonight I suspect will go down as something rather special. Wonderful performances from Christian Stotter, ex-Radio 3 New Generation artist, originally trained as a violinist and then had a period of intensive retraining, much to our delight, at the Amsterdam Conservatory. Simon Keeneyside, of course, much loved here at the Proms. Huge orchestra here on stage. You will have heard all those variety of drums, many xylophones, glockenspiels, all those different percussion instruments on stage. Fantastic spectacle, I must say, to be able to see it here. And being brought to their feet again by the composer and conductor tonight, Thomas Adders. Such a star. Currently working on his third opera. The first was Powder Her Face, then The Tempest, as I mentioned. He came to real prominence when he was still such a young man, when Sir Simon Rattle commissioned and premiered his work Asyla with the CBSO. I think he was still in his 20s at the time, early 20s. But as the applause just gradually begins to die out now, it is time for me to say goodbye. Tomorrow night's Prom Live here on BBC Radio 3 features the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. We've got Thomas Sondergaard conducting Stenhammer and Richard Strauss's Alpine Symphony. They're joined by the BBC Chorus of Wales, BBC Symphony Chorus, for Szymanowski's Third Symphony, The Song of the Night. That's all part of our Polish theme here at the Proms. But I do hope you've enjoyed tonight's concert. I should mention, of course, there are all sorts of different ways of enjoying the Proms online. You can listen again to various Proms which have already been heard in the last few days. The cheers continue for Thomas Adders, who's just come back on. Looking pleased, if a little tired and hot. And don't forget, of course, lots of Proms on television. BBC 4 tomorrow at 7:30. I'll be introducing Mahler's Fifth, which the Bamberg Symphony Orchestra performed a couple of days ago. So do join me there. But now, I think I really should go and hand you back to John Shea in Broadcasting House.
Katie, thank you very much. That was Katie Derham at the Royal Albert Hall. And tomorrow night's Prom, which she just told us about, featuring Strauss's Alpine Symphony, begins at the earlier than usual time of 7 o'clock. Well, tonight's Prom is given another airing here on BBC Radio 3 on Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. As Katie said, there are many ways to enjoy the Proms. You can listen to it again, of course, via the Radio 3 website for the next 7 days. And part of tonight's concert will be shown on television on BBC 4 on Sunday week. That's the 28th of July in the evening, beginning at 7:30. It's not just the music of the Proms that you can listen to again online. You can also hear tonight's interval programme, that Proms Plus literary event, via the Radio 3 website, as well as the two Sunday features mentioned during it. They were presented by one of Rana Mitter's guests, the writer Eva Hoffman, on the Jewish presence in Poland. They're still available for you to listen to again, or indeed to download as podcasts. That's all via the BBC Radio 3 website.
At the BBC Proms and live on BBC Radio 3, Viva Verdi. The second in a pair of concerts from Sir Antonio Pappano and the orchestra of the Rome Academy of Santa Cecilia includes the four sacred pieces and from the Requiem, the dramatic Liberame. Saturday night at the BBC Proms from 7:30.
Our next programme this evening, in 3/4 of an hour from now, is another chance to hear a feature that we first broadcast last year. Tonight we travel to a strange garden in Mexico, one of the foremost concrete artworks in the world, built by an eccentric millionaire English art collector. Edward James and the Surreal Garden is at 10:15 tonight, and after that Max Reinhardt will be here at 11 with Wednesday's Late Junction. Well, let's follow Thomas Addis's Totentanz, which we've just heard in the second half of tonight's Prom, with more music associated with the city of Lübeck. In the 17th century, the post of organist at the Marienkirche was one of the most prestigious in northern Germany. Dietrich Buxtehude was appointed to that post in 1668, and when he carried on his predecessor's practice of giving organ recitals. Chorale fantasias were an important North German tradition, elaborations of chorale melodies, one phrase at a time. And let's hear one of those now that Buxtehude wrote for his recitals. This is his version of Nun freut euch lieben Christen gemein. This is a Dutch radio recording. Theo Jellema plays the organ of St. Martin's Church in Groningen.
Thank you.
That was Buxtehude's Chorale Fantasia on Nun freut euch lieben Christen gemein, and it was played on a Dutch organ. Theo Jellema was playing on the instrument in St Martin's Church in Groningen. Well, from music associated with the city of Lübeck, let's move a little further along the Baltic coast and return to another of this evening's themes, Polish music. This is a dramatised biblical dialogue by a composer some two decades older than Buxtehude. Kaspar Förster was born in Danzig, as the Polish city of Gdansk was known then, in 1616. And this is his version of the story of Judith and Holofernes, the beautiful widow deflecting the siege of her hometown by getting the enemy commander drunk and then cutting off his head. The story provided plenty of inspiration for painters such as Michelangelo and Caravaggio, also for 17th century composers such as Förster, who wanted to imitate the biblical dialogues that were so popular then in Italy.
Thank you. Fugine tremens,
a biblical dialogue from the 17th century, Viri Israelite, the dialogue of Judith and Holofernes, set to music by Kasper Förster and sung by Olga Pasichnik, Kai Vessel, Krzysztof Schmidt and Grzegorz Zichowicz with the Il Tempo Baroque Ensemble. Well, let's fast forward 3 centuries now for the Polish composer featured in tomorrow night's prom by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, Karol Szymanowski. In 1915, he wrote a set of 3 piano pieces that he called Metopes, or Metope, to give it its French title. Now, if you've ever seen the Elgin marbles, you'll probably know that metopes are the square spaces in a Greek frieze. Well, like those, Szymanowski's pieces illustrate stages in a history, here based on Homer's Odyssey. We're going to hear the first of the 3 pieces, Isle of the Sirens, which refers in its music to various details from Homer's story, including a lullaby theme, and evoking the double flute and lyre that Homer associates with the sirens. The pianist here is Dennis Lee. Dennis Lee playing music by Karol Szymanowski, one of his metopiece, The Isle of the Sirens. While Szymanowski was abandoning all German influence and thoroughly embracing musical impressionism there, as I think you can hear. And the same goes for this last piece in the sequence this evening. Hardly surprising, since Szymanowski wrote it in the same year, 1915. A new form of expression in violin playing is how he later described the piece. His inspiration is the spring to be found near Syracuse in Sicily, the fountain of Arethusa. According to the legend, the nymph Arethusa escaped the advances of the god Alpheus and was turned into a spring by Artemis. From the beginning, the piano imitates the movement of the water. Seung-hae Choi is the violinist here with Hyun-mi Kim at the piano.
Thank you.
The Fountain of Arethusa by Carol Szymanowski, played by Seung-hye Choi, violin, and Hyun-mi Kim, piano. As I mentioned, Szymanowski's Third Symphony, The Song of the Night, is one of the works on the BBC National Orchestra of Wales' prom tomorrow night. That's in the first half, along with Steinhammer's Excelsior Overture, and after the interval, it's crampons and pickaxes at the ready for Strauss's Alpine Symphony. An early start, 7 o'clock tomorrow. Don't miss it. Well, we're off to Latin America in our feature next tonight here on Radio 3, but don't forget there's more chamber music every weekday lunchtime.
Over the course of the prom season, from now until the 2nd of September, every Monday lunchtime, Radio 3 heads to London's Cadogan Hall for chamber music of all shapes and sizes. A stellar cast of musicians includes pianist Imogen Cooper, tenor Ian Bostridge, and trumpeter Tina Ting-Helset, along with the UK premiere of Sir Harrison Birtwistle's The Moth Requiem. Chamber music at the BBC Proms. Live Monday lunchtimes at 1 o'clock on BBC Radio 3, or catch up with the first concert featuring violinist Vilde Frang by going online to the Radio 3 website.
Meanwhile, let's not forget that on other days of the week we have highlights from the East Nuke Festival in Fife all this week. Tomorrow it's Beethoven and Mozart from Christian Zacharias and the Elias Quartet. Join Penny Gore for that tomorrow afternoon just after the 1 o'clock news. Back to this evening, Max Reinhardt is here at 11 with Wednesday's Late Junction, but now at just after 10:15, another chance to hear a programme first broadcast on Radio 3 in June last year, in which we travel to a strange garden in Mexico, one of the foremost concrete artworks in the world. It was built by the English art collector Edward James and his splendidly named friend Plutarco Gastelum. The journalist Joanna Moorhead explores the dramatic story behind the garden's construction and the struggle for its preservation in Edward James and the Surreal Garden.
I grew up in Mexico, I was born in Mexico, and we never used the name Xilitla, we used the name El Jardín del Inglés. No, so the Englishman's garden. It was particularly strange because since we in Mexico have a strong relationship with that kind of nature, the fact that an Englishman came and put a garden in the middle of Xilitla, eccentric, extravagant, no?
It was an odd and ambitious endeavour, as filmmaker Rafael Ortega points out. The Englishman in question arrived here in the mid-1940s as a coffee plantation. In the decades that followed, he returned the terraced slopes to tropical rainforest and filled several acres with a fantastical array of concrete sculptures. The garden has acquired mythical status.
I had seen a lot of the photographs and I had no idea of the real proportion of the place until you were standing there.
Look up, and a twisted column reaches 20 metres above you. You start to feel very small. Choose a pathway and it narrows. Approach a doorway. You're wrong-footed by the perspective and find yourself turning sideways just to get through.
This concrete footbridge traverses a deep drop. It's extraordinary.
You're in a pavilion or a palace on a ledge dwarfed by the surrounding trees. And all around, sculpted entirely from concrete, are pillars, bridges and walkways that mimic the exaggerated forms of petals, flowers and plants.
It just breaks completely with the rules of proportion in architecture in terms of, I would say, comfort. You know, it's not a comforting feeling going to Xilitla.
Not surprisingly, the sensation of losing oneself in this wonky labyrinth of hillside pathways and hidden ruins has captured the imagination of a new generation of artists.
The first feeling I remember having was this verticality of the place.
Melanie Smith, who worked with her partner Rafael Ortega to create the piece Xilitla Dismantled for the Venice Biennale, first visited the garden 10 years ago.
The structures themselves, they're very toppled on top of each other. The whole place itself is very dense and very vertical.
Something about it, I mean, there's something childish about it and something
playful,
very playful in the way he did it.
Edward James was the Englishman and aristocrat whose imagination and immense wealth created this monumental piece of outsider art. He described himself as a child who never grew up. It says poet on the grave at his large ancestral estate in West Dean, Sussex, but he's probably better known for funding Salvador Dali and René Magritte in their early years, and for the lobster telephone and Mae West lit sofa, which he co-designed with Dali. Outwardly chaotic and often referred to as an eccentric, he was a patron in the traditional sense. He published John Betjeman's first book of poetry, financed a ballet for Georges Balanchine. But his mercurial character and his garden are still something of a puzzle.
His life was completely fascinating on the one side, and on the other side, the question is always there. Why here?
Hillitla, it's the perfect place because it's a place where I never have to worry about the loss of the Louis XV bronzes, and I somewhat enjoy the absence of anything precious that causes so much.